Jeff's Guitar Clinic is a multifaceted shop offering guitars, amplifiers, and all accessories, guitar lessons for all ages, and instrument repair of the highest quality. Take the scenic drive to beautiful Fort Atkinson and see what total customer satisfaction is all about. Call Jeff's Guitar Clinic today at 920-723-1733. That's Jeff's Guitar Clinic at 920-723-1733. Jeffsguitar.com.
I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep SlysOffice.com up and going so you keep up to date, whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from SlysOffice.com.
Welcome to another podcast at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. Today, joining us, John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Well, before we get to the constitutional crisis in the country, you know, one of the things that President Trump likes to tout is Neil Gorsuch. And I think a lot of us were concerned when Neil Gorsuch was put on the court that he would not only be a conservative justice, but that he would be a corporatist. And I think that's probably turned out to be true, John.
It has totally turned out to be true. And, you know, look, I don't think that was a debatable point. In fact, I think the important thing to understand is that too much of our coverage of Supreme Court nomination fights and even judicial fights runs down a appropriate and important yet narrow track. And that is, we look at where they stand on a host of social issues.
Right.
It is important to explore that, and I think that can be qualifying and disqualifying. So it's not to diminish that, but we have to understand there's also another area, in fact, the bigger area in which the court operates, and that is in the area of regulation of business, you know, corporate issues, regulatory issues.
Right.
Union issues.
And that's
the area where I think Gorsuch was.
Well, let's get right down to brass tacks here. We're talking about Epic and several other companies forcing people into basically the company store's arbitration. Explain.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you get a job, right, in a non-union workplace, and you sign a basically a deal with them, or a contract, an agreement. You could give it whatever name you want. And that says, I'm going to abide by a certain set of requirements. And that set of requirements essentially requires you to surrender a lot of what we think of as your rights as not just a worker, but as a citizen. You know, that if you're in a situation in a workplace where inappropriate things are happening or unfair things, unjust things, that that you know, we have a right as Americans to sue, and in some other way take legal action, and what many companies are now doing is having you sign a piece of paper that essentially gives up those rights, and in a non-union workplace, especially if you've given up those rights, if you are then treated unfairly, if something happens to you that is inappropriate. You have incredibly limited ability to challenge it.
And they get to pick the ref.
Yeah, and you go into a so-called arbitration. And, you know, arbitrations can be good and bad. Arbitration is a big part of the law now in America. And there are some areas where it actually works out reasonably well. But in employment law and in workplace situations, especially when you're involving major issues, arbitration often is insufficient. It isn't the answer because, as you suggest, you know, somebody may pick the ref, but it goes beyond that as well. It's, you know, you're talking sometimes about huge consequential issues, big deal subjects that frankly ought to go to the courts, right? That judges should sort out. And they might sort it out on the side of the worker. They might, and the workers, they might sort it out on the other side. But in an arbitration setting, you know, it's tending to sort of dumb down the negotiation, if you will, and the efforts to sort an issue out. So I think in general, in workplaces, it's not the way you want to go.
Here's a couple quotes. Here's Neil Gorsuch, Justice Gorsuch. He says, the policy may be debatable, but the law is clear. Congress has instructed that arbitration agreements like these, those before us, must be enforced as written, Gorsuch wrote. Ruth Bader Ginsburg authored the dissenting opinion and delivered it from the bench, calling the majority opinion egregiously wrong. She was joined by Stephen Breyer and Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan. It's interesting that Breyer voted with the liberals, because sometimes he votes with conservatives on business issues, but even he voted in this case against this decision. She said the inevitable result of today's decision will be the under-enforcement of federal and states designed to advance the well-being of vulnerable workers.
That's exactly right. And that's the, you know, the thing is that, unfortunately, the United States is under-unionized. We don't have the level of unionization that I would like to see, and that, frankly, I think you would see in so developed a country in most of the world.
Ours is very low, even compared to Canada's.
Right. Oh, very. Yeah. And so this is a big deal, because when you have strong unions, and they are, you know, all across the country, in all states, all regions, then just the presence of those unions creates a counterbalance. It is, if a company is really treating workers poorly, you know, if the non-union company, there's the prospect that it might quickly unionize. So because we're under-unionized as a country, then the courts become a place where a lot of labor law is enforced, and frankly, a lot of, you know, smart balances are struck. When you take the courts out of the process, right, when you say, no, this is going to be done in essentially a more internal operation in these arbitration agreements, you really do undermine the ability to enforce, you know, basic labor laws, basic protections in the workplace, which are on the books. And so where I think Gorsuch got it totally wrong, and where obviously Ruth Bader Ginsburg got it right, is that, you know, yeah, arbitration agreements, contracts, those things do have standing. You do take them seriously. But when they become a tool by which you essentially end the ability of the courts, or to dramatically undermine the ability of the courts to enforce laws that are on the books, law standards that
right.
apply to everybody, that becomes hugely
important. In this case, it had to do with massive amounts of overtime. So they say the case, you know, this is a precedent-setting case. It dealt to federal laws that appeared to conflict the National Labor Relations Act in 1935, which provides and encourages employers to be collectively bargain and sue over labor disputes, and the Federal Arbitration Act of 1925, which states that arbitration agreements shall be valid and irrevocable and enforceable. So we've got two competing things here.
Well, we do it, but here's an interesting thing, Sly. The old National Arbitration Act existed at a certain time. We came out of that period, and we saw this, you know, Great Depression and the great challenges of the workplace, a new understanding of work, and that's where you got, you know, the Wagner Act, and you got, you know, a lot of our labor laws established. And, you know, it's my sense that they're really you're coming from very different places there. Again, arbitration agreements have, you know, standing, they're real, and they're, you know, you take them seriously. But we have since the 1930s, even somewhat going earlier in some child labor laws and things, we have set standards in this country as regards discrimination, as regards treatment of people in the workplace, as regards wages and hours. And, you know, it seems to me that, yeah, the court did have to deal with a conflict there. And the logical response is to say that, yeah, arbitration agreements can exist in certain circumstances, understandable, but they don't trump labor law. They don't trump workplace discrimination protections. They don't trump protections for wages and hours and for health and safety. Because if they do, Slide, then we have not universal standards for, again, discrimination, health and safety, you know, all wages and hours, all those things in the workplace. We have a patchwork quilt that is made, you know, better or worse based on whether you've got an arbitration deal. And I hate to tell you, but this Supreme Court ruling is going to, I think it's going to cause virtually every non-union workplace, and maybe they'll even try in some union places, it's going to cause just a rush to these arbitration agreements.
You know, it's
a way to opt out of a lot of stuff.
It's interesting, and yeah, and workers don't have much leverage. Ginsburg went a little further. She said, as I see it, in relatively recent years, the court's Arbitration Act decisions have taken many wrong turns. Yet, even accepting the court's decisions as they are, nothing compels the destructive result of the court reaches today. In other words, this is a series of bad decisions, but this is the worst.
Well, I tell you why. Because this, you know, you have a series of bad decisions in a context. You're saying, well, yeah, but we still have sort of, you know, these broader protections, and there's still a sense. Now what you've ended up with is a series of bad decisions that have been effectively codified, i.e., you know, made the standard. And I know that we don't talk about the courts codifying things. We don't talk about the courts writing laws. But I would say that this decision is an example of an activist judiciary effectively.
Oh, now you just put a dagger in Rick Essenberg's heart.
With all due respect, I mean, this is an activist court
now
making
that,
choices.
You're
going to
upset the Federalist Society.
Yeah, the Federalist Society ought to read, you know, ought to really read up on federalism a little bit. But this is a court actively making decisions on behalf of incredibly wealthy and incredibly powerful
interests, in this case,
people who might want to organize to challenge.
And
them.
In this case, it's Judy Faulkner, who's the CEO. And she said, of course, she's a well-known liberal in Wisconsin who owns Epic. She said, it's important that employers protect employees' right to file complaints while also providing for a fair forum in which those grievances are addressed. When it comes to grievances regarding wages and hours, we believe individual arbitration agreements strike that reasonable balance.
I hold to the view that that you always have the reasonable balance in a good workplace where a boss is humane and decent, ready to work with people. And, you know, that happens, without a doubt. But when the balance isn't struck, right, you know, when it doesn't work out, you don't want to take away the ability of the worker or large groups of workers to step out of the workplace, if you will, and ask for an independent judicial ruling as regards the treatment they're receiving. And so I think, you know, if you're looking for balance, there could be balance in any workplace. You know, people can really work a lot out, and I've seen it happen throughout the history of my work life. However, if it's not working, right, if there is something that's imperfect, and this is the important thing to understand. You know, we had certain companies involved with this case, but this case sets a precedent. And so, you know, even if there is a reasonable balance in, you know, some companies, this case essentially says, boy, you know, go find your worst players here, and they can set up these arbitration agreements and essentially take people, and imagine this, Sly, folks who, you know, aren't in high-tech, top-of-the-line, you know, relatively high-paying jobs, but are in really vulnerable positions, working in a rural workplace.
Look, you've got sub shops like Jimmy John's forcing drivers to sign no compete agreements. In other words, if they lose their job, they can't go drive
for another pizza place.
A pizza or someplace, right?
Right.
Here is former Wisconsin Governor Jim Doyle, who sits on the board of Epic. Interesting, they brought him front and center. I didn't even know that he was on the board of Epic until this happened. Mm-hmm. He said, Epic is a unique company that understands its most important assets are its people, employee-owned and homegrown in the Badger State. They've eschewed the quick and profitable path of outsourcing abroad or acquiring other companies in favor of investing over 80% of their operating costs in their people. Interesting coming from a guy who endorsed the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yeah, and you know what? So this is the important thing to understand about this. A good portion of what he says is true. Epic has invested tremendously in this region, and it is a company that has actually been really good to a lot of people. But the courts don't rule in individual cases with individual companies.
Right, exactly.
This is a precedent. So it's not, I think people have to be very, very careful here.
Well,
I just don't agree with the way Jim Doyle's framed
Epic, yeah.
Way to frame it.
Well, Epic is not a perfect company. And obviously there are some problems with people working incredible amounts of hours. And if they're not getting overtime, then I think that is a problem.
Sure. It is any place. But what I'm saying is the danger we get into in circumstances like this is to say, oh, yeah, well, this is a good company, right? Or this is a pretty good company, or this is acceptable. The problem is that this court isn't about individual companies. This is an activist court that is seeking to undermine the rights of workers, not merely in Dane County or in Wisconsin, but across the country. It is setting precedents that are weakening the hand of workers rather than strengthening them. And remember, this is the court that is expected in relatively short order to do the Janus decision or do a Janus decision. We don't know how it's going to come out, but there's a lot of feeling.
Doesn't look good.
It's going to be a very anti-worker ruling. And then, frankly, this is a court where one member, Justice Alito, has clearly signaled a desire to go much more aggressively in deconstructing the limited rights that are still
right,
you know, in place. So, I mean, you have to see it in that context. And so I am not comfortable with people.
Well, this is...
This is a
stain on Epic. This the fact that they pushed this case as well as a couple other companies. This has tarnished their reputation.
I think it's one that, you know, look, this is going to come back to haunt. It's going to come back to haunt a lot of people in a lot of settings. And I really counsel that there are ways to respond to this. And one of the ways to respond is legislatively. You know, Congress can pass, obviously this Congress under Paul Ryan will not.
Paul who?
Congress can.
Who?
Yeah, the former speaker. So
right.
The fundraiser, as we refer to him. But Congress can address this because the court was dealing with, you know, conflicting laws, conflicting
right. All
signals.
Right. All right.
And it's really important that Democrats, if there are any left, that Democrats actually make a big deal about seeking to address this legislatively.
We'll take a break. John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation with us at sliceoffice.com.
Injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
When you hire a lawyer to help you with your personal injury, you want to know that you'll have that lawyer's personal attention. With John and I, that's exactly what you'll get. With many firms, the lawyer that you see in the ad is not the lawyer who is going to be representing you in the case.
One of the differences with Mike and my practice is that when you hire us, you'll have us personally involved in your case.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
We're back at sliceoffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. Great local sponsors like Madison Computer Works and S&R Remodeling. All right, let's talk a little bit about the constitutional crisis going on. Investigating the investigators. Here's ABC News.
Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and FBI Director Christopher Wray arrived at the White House today for a meeting with a president highly agitated about the Russia investigation. I hereby demand, the president declared, that the Department of Justice look into whether or not the FBI DOJ infiltrated or surveilled the Trump campaign for political purposes, and if any such demands or requests were made by people within the Obama administration. He seems to be following through on a threat he made last month on Fox and Friends.
You look at the corruption at the top of the FBI, it's a disgrace. And our Justice Department, which I try and stay away from, but at some point I won't.
The president's new demand comes in response to a New York Times report that the FBI in late 2016 used an informant to question two Trump campaign associates about their contacts with Russians. But there is no evidence the FBI infiltrated the Trump campaign. Today, Rosenstein made light of his high-profile predicament.
Deputy attorneys general are very low profile, tend not to be recognized.
He has now ordered the Justice Department's internal watchdog to look into the president's concerns, saying, quote, if anyone did infiltrate or surveil participants in a presidential campaign for inappropriate purposes, we need to know about it and take appropriate action. Today, the president received a friendly warning from his ally, Chris Christie, cautioning attacks on the investigation could backfire.
I've told him many times that there's no way to make an investigation like this shorter, but there's lots of ways to make it longer. And he's executed on a number of those ways to make it longer.
And if anybody knows investigations, it's Chris Christie.
Yeah. He's actually investigated people relatively close to the president.
And people have investigated him.
Absolutely, and continue, I think, in some way. But there he was speaking as a former federal prosecutor, and he actually knows what he's talking about. This notion that trying to game the system by pressuring it often has unintended consequences. A, one of them being to make the investigation longer. A second one, to open up avenues of inquiry that can come back in your face. And, you know, here's the interesting thing, Sly. I thought Rosenstein's statement was fine, right? Let me put a couple things on the table. Number one, the president or any political figure has a right to say, I want to know if my campaign was infiltrated. And, you know, for inappropriate reasons, right? Now, that if they say that, if they say, I want to know if I was being spied on, in ways that might have helped my opponents or that might have had political consequences, political intents. The president has every right to say that. And Rosenstein's response, absolutely appropriate, right? We're going to look into it. If there was something inappropriate, that's cool. But, remember, this notion of infiltration, right? This is inflated. This is not something that everybody agrees that the Trump campaign was infiltrated. In fact, it's not something that has evidence to sustain that.
Well, that's just it.
That there's an investigation going on, right? And you do question people, and some people do talk to you. And what Trump seems to be doing here is trying to influence the investigation, pressure it by suggesting that anybody who was associated with his campaign or who was around his campaign who might talk to the FBI is somehow part of a conspiracy to, you know, warp our politics.
Let's play another Chris Christie clip.
I've told him many times that there's no way to make an investigation like this shorter, but there's lots of ways to make it longer. And he's executed on a number of those ways to make it longer. Bob Mueller himself is not a partisan. He's an honest guy. He's a hardworking guy. He's smart. And you can't argue that the investigation hasn't been effective so far. Got a number of guilty pleas, a couple of indictments in a year. It's pretty good work.
Whoa. I guess maybe when folks were thinking who might, you know, become part of the Trump legal team, the choice of Giuliani may have foreclosed a Christie presence there.
Maybe so.
You're getting my picture here?
Yeah, I'm getting your picture.
It's like Chris realizes he is now an independent player.
He is
indeed. That was a remarkable statement.
That was a remarkable statement. Now, juxtapose that with the vice president's, the former governor of Indiana.
I think it's time that the special counsel wrap it up. The truth is, it's been now more than a year. The special counsel has a team around them that's been looking into all of the allegations here. And with the full cooperation of the White House, they've been able to assemble the facts. And I continue to hope and to say very respectfully that the special counsel ought to, with all deliberate means, complete their work.
Well, let's bring in our...
Well, there we go.
in my studied assessment. I am determined, with all of my legal knowledge and my skills, it's time to wrap it up. You know, I would give to that statement pretty much the same credibility or, you know, same respect that I would give to any of Spiro Agnew's statements defending Richard Nixon. You know, the fact of the matter is that this inquiry by Mueller, which has a lot of roots in things that Trump did, remember what Christie's talking about, unintended consequences, this investigation is just a year old. And if you look back at major inquiries into wrongdoing at the White House or, frankly, in other areas of our society, I mean, this is, we're not even scratching the surface here, time-wise. I mean, past inquiries have taken many, many, many years. And that's one of my frustrations with the special counsel. I wish we had a Congress that held hearings and investigated and checked and balanced the White House. Unfortunately, we don't. And so this is happening in a non-congressional setting, coming in a way that extends in some ways from the executive branch via Department of Justice. But that's, you know, that's what we're stuck with. Some of my Republican friends who are so critical of this inquiry and want to shut it down or wrap it up or whatever phrase they're using, you know, if they would simply do their job, and their job is established by the Constitution, which they swear an oath to obey, respect, defend, is to check and balance presidents. And that means investigations and inquiries. And if they don't like the secrecy of it, they could be doing it in open congressional hearings. But they're not doing their job. And so Mueller is pursuing this. It's going to take more time. I think that Giuliani now is telling us that it'll be done in September. But I have no reason to believe that Giuliani
I don't
knows
put much credence in
there.
Anything that he says. Let me ask you something
that's what I'm saying.
Before we go today. I want to ask you about the U.S. Senate race. I'm sure you saw the story that State Senator Leah Vukmir and her challenger, Kevin Nicholson, spoke to Pro-Life Wisconsin and signed on 100% to their entire agenda, which includes banning all abortions, even in cases of life of the mother and rape, called for a personhood bill to extend constitutional protections to preborn humans. Such a bill, according to a survey, said the life of each human begins at fertilization. And for certain restrictions on stem cell research, which would devastate the University of Wisconsin program. Now, I think of the history of Wisconsin senators and Wisconsin governors. Lee Dreyfus was marginally pro-choice. I don't think Warren Knowles even talked about abortion. Tommy Thompson was pro-life, but certainly supported exceptions for the life of the mother and rape and incest. This is a whole new kind of wacky.
This is going to extremes. And remember that we have many anti-choice groups in Wisconsin. It's not just Right to Life. There's also this Pro-Life Wisconsin. There are other groupings that are out there. And they don't all read from the exact same page. They have different standards, different demands. And the fact of the matter is that historically, conservative Republicans in Wisconsin operated in a anti-choice zone. They were opposed to the right to choose. But it was, you know, it was within relative boundaries, right? It's clear now that in the race between Nicholson and Vukmir to be the most extreme, they've gone way beyond those boundaries. I don't know what that would mean if they were elected, whether they're sincere or whether they would, you know, abandon, you know, statements they've made, promises they've made. Certainly, Leah Vukmir's career does not suggest that she is, you know, a really consistent player on a host of issues. But on these issues, she has been very, very conservative throughout her career. But whatever it is, wherever they end up, this is a part of what people have to consider.
I noticed.
And what they have to consider is that these candidates are not running to be heirs even to Bob Caston.
Right.
They are running to be far to the far more extreme.
More extreme than Ron Johnson, which is pretty extreme. So, interesting. Mitch McConnell put out a list of the races he thinks are going to be the most competitive, and he's concerned the Republicans could lose the Senate. You know what state wasn't on there?
I know.
Wisconsin wasn't on there. What do you make of that?
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting thing. I think that Wisconsin will be high stakes. I don't think there's any question.
Well, they pump so much money in here.
What's that?
The right wingers pump so much money in here.
Yeah, and so I think that because of independent right wingers who they're quite certain will come in. Remember, Buchmeier has been so aligned with the Koch brothers and Alec and other groups for so long. Nicholson obviously has his benefactor in our friend from Illinois, and so. As a result, it may be, in a very honest assessment here, it may be that McConnell is trying to steer interest elsewhere and money elsewhere because he knows that Wisconsin is always going to have a sufficient level. But, another theory, another analysis might be that he's trying to send a signal. I don't think McConnell's given up on Wisconsin, but he's trying to send a signal to Buchmeier and Nicholson, frankly, that they need to get their acts together because the truth of the matter is, if Buchmeier and Nicholson at this point are running absurd campaigns,
that thing that Buchmeier tweeted out with Baldwin, was remarkably one of the most stupid things. It was even called out by James Wigerson from Wright, Wisconsin,
and I give him credit for that, and I give other conservatives credit for that. What they're saying, as people who really do want to win this seat, is you two are going to weird places here. You're going to places that are not helping you.
Oh, you
and
don't think of calling...
I would
calling,
suggest that maybe what McConnell is also trying to say.
Not saying veterans that happen to be Democrats have cognitive issues? You don't think that's in the mainstream?
No, I do not.
I had two World War One era grandfathers that both served in World War One in different capacities. One was a Democrat. The other was a Republican. Guess what? They were both patriots.
Well, bottom line, Sly, the fact of the matter is that, look at who served in our U.S. Senate, right? Bob Kerry, John Kerry, John McCain, Chuck Hagel. You know what I mean? We can find heroic figures in both parties and, frankly,
Tammy
along
Duckworth.
Tammy Duckworth right now, along the ideological spectrum. Now, what's interesting and striking to me is how many veterans, particularly Iraq War era veterans, are running as Democrats this year.
Connor Lamb.
And I just would suggest this. I think that Nicholson should be honored for his service, right? But I wouldn't suggest that his service was necessarily more honorable.
Listen,
than that of Tammy Duckworth.
He has the support of Missouri Governor Eric Greitens, and I think we can leave it right there. John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation at SlysOffice.com.
SlysOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
You know, we work hard every day in mills and mines, hospitals and schools, in office buildings, pharmacies and shipyards, factories and forests, in squad cars, ambulances and taxicabs. We do all kinds of jobs in Iowa, Wisconsin, Illinois, and all across the United States and Canada. We build the things that build our country. We do things that keep our country going, support our families and our communities. We have the courage to stand up even when no one else does. We have the strength to fight for what's right, for our families and for yours. We're your friends, your neighbors, your sisters and brothers. We're more than 1 million members strong. We stand in solidarity with workers in every continent on the globe. We're the United Steelworkers Union, and every day we fight for you. Please join our fight. Visit usw.org or like us at facebook.com/steelworkers.